8:09. This Friday afternoon, January the 9th, 1976, seated in my office is William Morgan of the Morgan Family and Alliance, whose father and grandfather were associated with Morgan Engineering, and he also carried on that tradition. I want to talk with him about the Morgan Engineering Company and something about his recollections growing up in what is familiarly referred to as the Morgan Mansion or Morgan Castle. Well, first of all, I might mention this is an awful cold afternoon, and it's much better sitting in here to do this kind of interview. I don't know what you want to refer to first. You probably don't recall your grandfather.
No, actually, my grandfather died in 1897, which was 7 years before I was born, almost 7 years.
Yeah.
So I never knew
him. Stories or characteristics that you recall in your family about him?
Oh, yes. Probably to give you the proper background on him. My grandfather, his name was Thomas Reese Morgan, was born in Penny Barron, Wales, which is a suburb of Merthyr Tydfil, which is one of the Morganshire and South Wales. And at that time, it was definitely coal mining country. I think the mines have since been pretty well exhausted in that part of Wales, and I don't think there's too much of it anymore. But my grandfather went to work in a mine as a very young boy, and I think when he was somewhere around 11 years old, he fell under a mine car and lost a leg in the accident, which almost cost his life. The leg had to be amputated at the knee, and he always wore an artificial leg after that. after recovering, he learned the machinist trade at what was then the largest steel company in England, or in the, not in England, rather in the United Kingdom, called the Dallas Ironworks, which is also in Wales. And he worked there for a number of years.
Now, how do you spell that Dallas?
D-O-W-L-A-I-S.
Okay.
And he subsequently married Elizabeth Nicholas, who's my my grandmother. And grandfather apparently decided that he would like to come to the United States. He felt there was much more opportunity over here than in Wales. And he left there in the spring of 1865 with his wife and three children. And they arrived in New York Harbor the morning after Lincoln was shot, which was April 15th, 1865. And my father often told me that my grandfather's first impression of America was that all the buildings had been draped in black
honor of
President Lincoln. They then went on to Pittston, Pennsylvania, which is a town in the hard coal area of Pennsylvania, not too far from Scranton. And my father was born there 6 weeks after the family landed, so he really has barely made it to the country. I think that my grandfather worked in railroad shops there. I'm not sure what he did, but he moved from there to Johnstown, PA, where he worked in the Cambria Steel Company, or Cambria Iron Company, and from there to Pittsburgh. And I think that he was only in Johnstown, I think, 2 or 3 years, and then he moved to Pittsburgh. And in 1868, he decided to form his own company for the manufacture of steam hammers. And he formed a company in Pittsburgh in 68 and moved to Alliance in 1871. Now, exactly what the circumstances or why he came to Alliance, I'm not at all certain. But I believe that perhaps the reason was that he somewhere or other got in touch with a man by the name of Florian Marchand. And I think Mr. Marchand owned some real estate in Alliance, and through that got my grandfather to come out here. And
of course, Alliance was an important railroad center in those days.
Yes, it was, although the railroads were really just getting started. Mm-hmm. But it seemed like a good spot for him, and they moved out here in 1871. And the company at that time was known as Marchand and Morgan. It continued until, I believe, about 1877. And my grandfather bought out Marchand and took another partner in by the name of Silas Williams, who was later one of the founders of Transit Williams. It continued as Morgan Williams and Company until about 1884. My grandfather bought out Williams, and the company from then on was known as Morgan Engineering Company. Mm-hmm. And it continued as it was a family company. My father and his two older brothers were in it, and he had two younger brothers who came along later. And it continued as a family-owned company for a number of years. It was incorporated in 1900. And has continued on through the years.
Mm-hmm. And you're at the death of your grandfather,
yes, he died in 1897.
Now, did your father take over at that time?
My father, having two older brothers, apparently the fact that my grandfather designated my father as to be president of the company didn't sit too well with John Morgan and Tom Morgan, who were the two older members of the family. And they pulled out of the company and went their own way. So from 1897 on, they were out. Mm-hmm. My grandfather also left some share in his estate to my father's sister, who was Margaret Ramsey, she's known as Maggie Ramsey, and also to her husband, Willis H. Ramsey, who was for many years treasurer of the company. And the Ramseys and the father were the principal owners of that terminal.
Now, the Ramseys, of course, built on the hill there at the Union, which is the Phi Kappa Tau house.
They built the Phi Kappa Tau house, correct.
Yes. Right.
They had lived previous to that in my grandfather's house, which was on the southwest corner of Liberty and Oxford, mm-hmm. which is now, I believe, it's an Italian club.
Yeah. It's hard to recall for many people now to think that Alliance used to be way down toward the square. There was just nothing out much this way at all.
That's true. Mount Union, of course, was originally a separate town.
That's right. Yes.
The advent of the automobile was the city.
It began to spread, right.
With really horse travel and streetcars later, people normally lived near their place of work.
That's
actually,
right.
They lived
down there in the plant. I've done a little bit with some aspects of local history, but one of the interesting pictures that I come across is a picture of the Morgan Engineering Company band that grandfather had and went around to many patriotic and civic affairs.
Grandfather apparently was quite interested in band music and formed a band at the plant, and I understand that they went out and tried to hire good musicians to work in the plant, but the drafts needed them in the band. Apparently, it was a very good band back in the 80s and early 90s.
Right. And I come across a reference that he had political aspirations, but apparently never made the...
Yes, he did.
He did?
As a matter of fact, he ran for Congress on a Republican ticket in 1892. But that apparently was a bad year for the Republicans, and he was defeated by, let's see, a band with the name of Eichert from East Liverpool. Mm-hmm. But after that, he did not seriously enter any race for public office. Mm-hmm. And he was a very close friend of President McKinley. And I think there was some talk about the time of his death that he might be appointed as a consul to Prince Cardiff, Wales.
Oh, yes.
Because mm-hmm. his grandfather at that time was wanting to turn more of the operation of the company over to the boys.
Sure.
And people would like to retire, perhaps. But of course, that didn't come about because of his death. Suddenly and unexpectedly.
Yeah. Right. You mentioned, of course, that he came from Wales, and in the early years, right after the Civil War, many of the workers in iron companies, steel companies, were Welsh. And of course, there was a great contingent of Welsh people. In fact, there were two churches here at Welsh.
A lot
churches.
Of them were Welsh, yes. Yeah. And of course, another Welsh settlement in Youngstown and Niles.
Right. And what was it? I think someone told me, had heard the story, that your grandfather went to one of these churches, the service would be in Welsh. Is that correct?
I think so. I'm not sure about that. Mm-hmm. But I think that could probably be the case.
So I suppose that really the first ethnic group in alliance was the Welsh.
I would imagine so.
Yes.
Of course, I've often heard it said that back in the 70s and 80s, East Broadway down near Mahoning was known as Irish Town, and there probably were a lot of Irish here at that time, too.
The railroad brought them.
Yeah, could well have been. Yes.
But I think the expert...
They might have been the first, because at that time
true.
There were very, very few Southern Europeans, as you know,
right.
who immigrated to this country. That
yes.
came
toward
a little
the
bit later on,
yes.
yeah, around 1900,
right.
90s, and then
yes.
1900. So I would imagine that they were probably
yes.
two
of the
largest
mm-hmm.
ethnic groups here.
Now you're...
I might also
all
tell
right.
you, my grandfather was quite... I think that he was really the most important figure in bringing more industry to the lands. He was one of the incorporators of a company called the Solid Steel Casting Company, which is directly across the tracks, and which is now the Amstead Industries, or American Steel Foundries.
Mm-hmm.
He also was instrumental in bringing the George Reeves to Alliance, who founded the Reeves Boiler Works, which is now one of the plants at Babcock Wilcox. And, of course, Alliance Machine Company was an offshoot of Morgan, too, but this
yes.
is a little bit later on. So I would say that really the fountainhead of industry in Alliance was Morgan.
Stemmed from your grandfather.
Yes, indeed.
Well, he must have had remarkable capabilities and leadership and management. And
from all I have learned, he was rather a perfectionist. And he insisted on every piece of equipment that left that plant had to be just exactly right. And if there were any blemishes or marks on it at all, somebody heard about it in no uncertain terms.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the reason that he succeeded. Well, then your father took over, and he was known as the Colonel. How did he get that for that
well,
title?
Well, my father was always quite active in Republican politics, and he was a friend of George Nash, who became governor of the state of Ohio along about 1900 around in that era. And at that time, The governor had a, well, they call it a military staff, but it was really a political appointment. And they had these various men, and they would call them Colonel so-and-so. And they wore the uniforms, everything. And they were the colonel, the governor's staff. And Dad was appointed the colonel on the governor's staff. And that's where he got it, and it stuck. But it was not a military title. It was actually political appointment, I would say, perhaps somewhat similar to a Kentucky
colonel. Yes.
But he carried it through his life. Everybody always called him the colonel.
Well, I didn't grow up in Elias, but when I came here, that's the reference I always heard, you know, was to Colonel Morgan. Yeah. Now, he continued in the company how long?
He continued until his death in 1928.
Yes. And then when did you become identified with Morgan?
Well, I graduated from college in 26, and I had work. Of course, I had worked there during summers, during my school years, sometimes several weeks, sometimes a month or two during summer vacation. And of course, I've always been very closely associated with the company. All my life, I've gone down there and visited it, been pretty familiar with it. And I actually really started work seriously there in 1926.
I see. Now, you went to Sheffield School of Science at Yale, right?
Yes, I went to Yale, Sheffield, which is the scientific school, you know, the Bachelor of Science in 1926.
And then you continued, and the family itself, with Morgan, how long then?
Well, I was with the company as an employee from 1926 until 1964, when it sold out.
Yes.
And I retired.
So you'd say that the 64, about almost 30 years, it's almost a century that this has been a family and Morgan concern.
I thought of it when I decided at the time to sell in 1964 that the only four more years the company was 100 years old. But I've always tried not to let sentiment get better at my business judgment, and I felt it was the time to get out. And I was 60 at the time, and it seemed to be the most reasonable thing to do.
Well, now let's go back a bit, and the type of product which Morgan put out. Your father's, or grandfather started as a steam hammer.
Morgan originally started as produced steam hammers. And for many years it was known as a hammer shop in Lance. Well, they branched out and they got into overhead traveling cranes. And they were into cranes in the late 70s and early 80s. And at that time, I think they're principal competition was Yale and Tom, which is much better known as a lock company, company that manufactures locks. But they built cranes at that time, and then subsequently they got out of the crane business. But during the 70s and early 80s, the cranes were driven by steam power. They had a shaft which was driven by from a remote control of the steam engine along the runway of the crane, and the crane would pick up its power from this shaft, and all the motions were controlled from called the square shaft. And it was a rather complicated piece of equipment, and I guess they were subject to a lot of breakdowns and a few more things. But as the electric era began to come in the early 80s, father had the idea that it would be much more practical to drive the cranes by electric power on the motors. And he built the first, in fact, was designed by my father, the first electric overhead crane ever built in this country, probably anywhere.
Now, did he go to school anyplace, or did
no,
he just
he
grow up in the plant?
My father went through fifth grade and started to work in the plant at that time. The family was poor. My grandfather, when he came over here, had practically nothing. And they had some pretty rough going for a long time. But as the younger brothers came along, they got a little bit better education, but unfortunately, they didn't take too much advantage of it. Too bad that the plant hadn't been going a little bit longer when my dad grew up. I think he would have perhaps had it. But he learned, he read a great deal. He was self-educated. Yeah. He was very well informed.
I recall reading references when the street railway first came here.
Yes.
I think Morgan Company was instrumental.
Yeah,
I think my father
was quite active in
right.
that too. Stark Electric Railway.
It just happened that the location here, the between Mount Union and Alliance, made it very fine situation rather than just within the town.
Apparently, so. Had been one of the early street railways here.
That's right. And I remember reading where they relied upon the judgment of Morgan Engineering Company.
Yeah, Father, I think Dad designed a lot of the equipment for
that's
them.
That's right.
And the first firehouse is on Miller Street, which is now a dairy.
Right.
Right by the LEA.
Dick Lamont tells me you can still see the remains of that building. It's been built on, but you can still see the remains of that old building.
That was the original firehouse for the Stark Electric.
Yes.
But it was not in operation during my lifetime, but I know of it. Yeah. Their main firehouse at that time was at Lake Park.
Mm-hmm.
And this Miller Street property was a laundry when I was quite young, mm-hmm. and then later on became a dairy. Been ever since.
Now, we were talking about overhead cranes. Has that been the product that Morgan has principally been identified with?
I would say yes, to a large extent. We also are in the rolling mill business, too, making looming mills and various other types of steel mill equipment, roller tables, shears.
Now, when we come to, say, to World War I, there was government contracts.
Yeah, well, actually, Morgan got into the ordnance business in 1894. There was a Captain Gordon, who was in the U.S. Ordnance Department, who had designed a disappearing gun carriage. This was designed for a 10-inch gun for coast defense. And somewhere out there, Morgan got into it, and we were selected to build this carriage. And our engineering department, and Dad was quite active in this development too, kind of smoothed out some of the problems on this particular gun. And they built it. They built one gun carriage in 1894. And it was designed to, the reason it was called a disappearing gun carriage, the gun would come up to the firing position and the recoil would put it down quite a distance so that when it was behind the parapet of a coast defense fort, it would disappear after firing so it would make no target for any ships who were attacking. And so that was the reason for the design.
Which that was before the day of the Wright brothers.
And they worried about airplanes then. This gun was successful. It was a very large piece of equipment for its day, and it made a number of very serious problems in handling these large castings that went into this carriage at the plant, but they got it together and shipped it out. I can't give you offhand the exact weight of it, but it was quite a heavy piece of equipment. They shipped it to Sandy Hook for tests, and then put it in one of those coastal forts. About 3 or 4 years later, there was an improvement on this design called the Buffington and Crozier carriage. And they built several of those. They were 12 inch. They were larger and an improved model. And that went on during the Spanish War. And then when World War I came along, the United States was, when we came into the war in 1917, we were extremely short of field artillery, particularly heavy pieces. So they, apparently the Ordnance Department at that time, decided to take a number of guns from the old Coast Defense Force and mount them into a mount of 6-inch guns on portable carriages, and some of the larger guns, 12-inch mortars and some 12-inch long rifle guns, under railroad mounts. And I think knowing Morgan's association with the Ordnance Department years before, they were very anxious that we get into this, took the field, which we did. And during World War I, we met with many, many guns. I think there were 91 of the 12-inch mortars, and I think there were a great many of the others. I don't have a figure anymore. Yeah. But I remember them very well.
Well, now, during that time, Morgan's, in a sense, was off-limits. It was a federal preserve. Were there guards there?
I understand it. During the Spanish War, they had a company of the Pennsylvania National Guard out here that guarded the plant. I don't know whether they expected an invasion from General Weiler to come up from Cuba up through Florida and finally get here or not. But anyway, they were here, but I think they were a little superfluous myself. During World War I, we had quite a number of officers here. They were really inspectors. I think the guard force was considerably reinforced. It was carefully guarded against any sabotage.
In World War II, then, you were...
World War II was a different proposition entirely. At that time, the United States was a little bit short on steelmaking capacity. So the government decided the best thing to do was to increased the capacity of steel plants, which made it necessary for us to stay right on our own product. Mm-hmm. So we did not do any ordnance work in World War II. That's what they wanted us to do. Mm-hmm. So we stay right on your present product because we need them. Mm-hmm. Not actually war equipment.
Now, during the period there, say from the turn of the century and then the time that you were active with the company, you shipped not only in the United States, it was not only a domestic, but this was a world exporter.
Yes, we had done some. We never did much in Western Europe because I think certainly Germany probably had the lead there. And at that time, there was such a tremendous difference between labor rates, costs in the United States and in Europe that they could undersell us.
Yes.
But we did sell quite a bit of equipment to Japan back in 1910, 1911, and period. And during World War I, before we entered the war, we still sold quite a bit of equipment to Tsarist Russia. They were still in on the Allied side. Right. This was before the Tsar was overthrown. And we shipped quite a bit of equipment to them. And we, of course, have also done some, shipped some, had shipped some equipment to India and Australia.
Is South America, is that
not right? Too much, that's been more recent.
Mm-hmm.
We shipped a couple of mills to Brazil, then to Argentina in the 50s.
Now, what's the technique on this? Do you build? You used to build it here and ship it. Now, in recent years, is it designed here and built where it's to be used, or what's the...
Normally, we would, of course, prefer to build it here. And during the early years of the Marshall Plan, 1946-47, we built a great deal of equipment from Western Europe, from Belgium, France, and Italy. But as Europe recovered from World War II, the only way we could sell our designs over there were to have them built in Europe, which we did to some extent. Mm-hmm. So we would have subcontractors in France, the other one in France, the other one in Belgium, the other one in Glasgow. And we also did some work on Zoom for the Germans, too, in other words.
If you were X years younger, would you look forward to China trade today, do you think, or is that a closed door?
Well, that gets into another question. I think my own personal opinion is that the Chinese will probably import a great deal more from Japan than they will from the United States. It's mm-hmm. closer than I think it is. Japan has now built themselves a tremendous deal last year. And I would think they would certainly be so attracted.
You think that the future for Morgan's then, as you see it now, would be domestic pretty largely, be within the United States or Canada?
Well, I have not been close to the heavy machinery. Heavy machinery business since 1964,
mm-hmm.
so I can't give anything really recent on it. I feel that the future Morgan should depend on their ability to diversify more than they have in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Our management has certainly been aware of this for many years, but it's easier said than done because you check into certain products and you find out that they're not quite into your picture as well as you thought.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very difficult, but I think that that's the answer.
Mm-hmm.
You have to diversify. We were too much in the open hearth corner of the steel industry. And as the open hearths have been supplanted by basic oxygen furnaces in the last 15 years, it has hurt a number of our products very badly.
Yes. You mentioned there about selling to Japan at a time. I recall on one occasion in visiting the Morgan Mansion, there was a was called a Chinese-Japanese room. Yes. Now, there was a story that your father entertained visitors from abroad in
rooms
appropriate.
Yes, that's true. I remember when I was quite young, we had a number of Japanese there.
Well, that gets back to the matter of the so-called castle now. What gave your father the idea or the notion to build this?
We lived at the corner of Liberty and Oxford on the south, it was on the southeast corner. That's where I was born. And I guess as the automobiles come in, then wanted to move out a little further and get himself a better house. And father was a type of individual who I would say he'd get into a project and he would get rather carried away by it. And he got an architect in Cleveland by the name of Willard Hirsch. And I think the two of them were quite similar in temperament And I think this thing just grew and grew and grew, and perhaps got a little bit too elaborate and too large. But my new father, he got into something, and he wouldn't stop. I mean, he got another idea, and well, we better put this in and this in. And the first thing you know, he got a pretty large place there. And it was extremely expensive to maintain. A little bit of, was really considerably over what we should have had.
But then that was a pattern for the turn of the century.
Oh, yeah.
There.
So I think a lot of people did it. That wasn't anything unusual at that time.
And so that...
Today, I think they look at the cost of upkeep a few more, I think a little bit more than they did then.
And unfortunately for the Romantics, that lays to rest the Wales or the Welsh story, and it was a Cleveland architect, and the granite came from...
Well, I know this thing developed, and he didn't know just what to build his house out. And he first considered sandstone, and he found that sandstone, being quite porous, I guess decidedly discolored, it's hard to keep it. And then he thought of Indiana limestone, which is used in the building. Well, I found that was had some problem with discoloration. So finally I ended up with Vermont marble.
Vermont
marble.
Yes.
And in Vermont, as you know, the house doesn't show the dirt at all.
Right.
I mean, it's very durable material.
As you think back in your boyhood growing up there, I'm sure there must be a number of experiences and some that you probably want to keep within the family,
well,
but are there some that you could share, some interesting or amusing?
People have often asked me if I enjoyed growing up in that place, which is quite an experience, but actually, I had a darn good time there. I enjoyed it very thoroughly. It was an excellent place to bring your friends and your loads of room to play and get in trouble. And, I enjoyed it thoroughly. That was great.
Now,
my parents they were people who liked to entertain and friends. They had to come together a lot. It was a very happy household.
Mm-hmm.
No problems occurred along that line at all. We had a very good existence there, no question about it.
Now, you speak today about looking at upkeep and all. You started out with how much personnel to take care of a place like that, do you recall?
Well, when we first moved in there, we had a farm at the back of the house. The farm had been there, of course. And Father thought, well, we could grow our own vegetables and then cows and then chickens and then all in one with it. And perhaps sell any excess amount of produce that we got from the farm. But I've heard many, many times it didn't quite work out that way. It would have been a little bit much cheaper to buy these things. And say, I don't know, they used to say if you had a real good farmer, he'd grab you blind. If he wasn't good, he wouldn't be able to grow anything. So you're hot either way. But anyway, that's here and there. But we did have that family back there. And also, as the cars came in, we had a chauffeur. Dad didn't drive himself. Apparently he did learn to drive a car in about 1905 or 6. And then, I don't know, for some reason, he gave it up. He never drove the rest of his life. But he also usually had a cook and a downstairs and upstairs and maid, the waitress, and So we clearly had a public some of the time. We used to have a night watchman. You know, we didn't really put a... Cool,
of course, without outlay, you simply had to have it. What about the lakes there? Were they created, or were they the result of clay excavation?
Well, that was actually quite a creek ran down through there, and they excavated them, and there are official lakes.
There was a
creek there, but mm-hmm. since the development of town, there was no overlooked drive or anything else between the college and there. That was all open land. And quite a volume of water drained down there. Okay. Of course, the city storm sewers are put in
everything. Yes. There was, or at least I have heard the story, that many bricks were taken out of that area, and someone said, well, the depression there formed those lakes.
As I understand it, there was a brick plant at one time. This is before my time. It stood about where the, I would say just north of the corner of Glenorian and Union, north on the northwest corner.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently they had taken some clay out of that. So that probably helped form the lakes.
Yes.
And that was gone long before I...
Yes, this... No, this was for buildings down... in Alliance, like the old opera house and buildings like that.
There was a brick plant there mm-hmm. at one time.
Yes, but this would be long before
yes.
that. Now, how many were there in the family? Was you...
I was the only one.
You were the...
I had an older sister who was 2.5 years older than I was, but she only lived 3 days.
I see.
And that was that. Yeah. I remember the sisters, people out there, didn't you get lonesome up there? I don't know, not at all. I had a lot of friends, and I went to South Lincoln Grade School, and I didn't have any friends. They used to come up there and have a pretty good time. Yeah.
Now, with the rooms and all, was that utilized pretty much, as you recall?
Well, I'd say we utilized a lot of it. It was a living room we used all the time. Well, there was a formal reception room downstairs. It was a Louis XV decor. And we never used it. Well, I guess people always used to have a Sunday parlor or something.
Oh, yes.
That's what this was.
Mm-hmm.
But, it was nice to look at. Yeah. Nobody ever used it. Other than that, I'd say we used it place very well. I was about to know what you know and took it away to you.
When was this completed?
Completed in 1905.
Mm-hmm.
I was a year and a half old when we moved there. And I understand that they moved the day before Thanksgiving.
Well, that would be quite an affair.
And I'm afraid I don't.
You don't remember that? No, I guess not. I guess not. But of course, they'd have horse and carriages
yes,
to start there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we used to have horses and carriages, which I remember very well.
Mm-hmm.
And we had horse and carriage for several years. With automobiles, because the cars weren't very good at that time, and you didn't dare depend on them too much.
Yes.
They'll break down on you anywhere. I'd say we had horses up to probably 1910,
mm-hmm. Well, now, this was sold in the 30s, wasn't it?
Yeah, my father died in 28. I was married in 1929 and moved up on Ridgewood Avenue. My mother continued to live in the house in 1929 to 30, she lived alone in the house after moving out in 29 until 1939. And the longer she lived there, the more she decided that she definitely wanted to get out of it. It took too much house, too expensive, and it was silly. And the only person now that she has me, many times. We're not a very affluent period.
Yes.
We're in a kind of the most severe depression since the Civil War in the early 30s. And even up until World War II started, real estate certainly in Alliance was just at a standstill. You couldn't give things away. But I talked to a number of possible buyers, including the college, and several other possibilities, but nothing came of it. And she almost decided that the only thing to do would be to raise the place and sell off the furnishings and what you could sell off, and then sell the land off. Well, unfortunately, the Elks came along and bought it in spring of 39. And then I moved to Cleveland to borrow the carts. It was nice to be there for 21 years after. And she was very happy too. She enjoyed it a lot. She, my mother, never really liked the house too well. She thought it was too much house.
And she was from Alliance, was she?
Yeah, she was. Oh, yes. Dad really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So she was very happy to get
rid of
it. It was a chore.
It would be. Yeah. Now you said you had you moved on Ridgewood. You live on Glamorgan now. Did you build the place where you now live?
Yes, my mother. I never built. Mother and I used to talk about it a lot. That's a good thing until we decide what happens to the big house. There's no sense in rebuilding.
Mm-hmm.
So when she sold the old house, she said, well, you should have a new house. And she helped me raise it substantially and started right on it that spring.
Mm-hmm.
We'd owned the ground. Father bought that ground on the north side of Glamorgan where I live. I believe in 1916 it was an old maple sugar camp at that time.
Hmm.
And it had never been cleared at all. And it had very lovely old trees on it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great spot. And, began built in 39, moved in 1940.
It is. You don't think in Alliance you see that, but the setting is with the trees and the shrubs that you have around. It is very scenic, very picturesque. So in a sense, you grew up, moved away, but you almost came back to the same location.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
So you've been there since. That's well, that's most interesting, and I think it's...
on my mother's side of the family, her father was also born in Alliance, John Sharon. And he was born in 1842 in the town of Fruden, which is part of the old town, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he grew up here. His father was in the... was a mortician, undertaker, and also a cabinet maker. That used to
go together.
Mm-hmm. And his father, Philip Sharon, came over here from Germany about 1839. And if I understand it, he came out, he got into Westmoreland County, probably somewhere in Somerset, I would guess, Pennsylvania. And I think he walked out here from there. He only had a few cents in his pocket. And he was a cabinet maker, and he could make a few things, and he'd self-started. And,
mm-hmm. Yes, I know, that's one of the old families from the Lions. Well, then on both sides of the family.
So I go back a few years on both sides.
That's right, yeah.
My father was 6 years old when he moved here. And of course, mom was born here, and they're fine.
Yeah, well, that's quite a contribution, a family like that, to the city.
Yes. I think many times there are things that I just sort of take for granted everybody knows, but as you get older, you find out the younger generation have forgotten a lot of things.
That's true. And
it's
think
hard to realize because you think, well, everybody knows this. And,
yes.
But that isn't the case.
Well, there was one interesting feature there. Morgan Engineering was going along, and then sometime after the turn of the century, and one of the workers or employees there became dissatisfied or saw a different horizon. This is Mr. Purcell, and branched out for himself.
Well, what actually happened, there was some Cleveland Capital men, the name of Cromwell, a fellow named Whitehead. And they decided to form a new company. They thought there was a future in this crane business. There ought to be more than one company in the thing. Mm-hmm. So they got the idea, and they contacted our general manager, who was William Purcell. And he went with them, but he really got the thing going. And later on, he took over and became president himself. But the first president of the last machine was Wilbur Whitehead, who you may or may not remember was quite a bridge authority back in the 1920s.
No, I don't.
He was one of the Gorin of that time. He didn't know he worked.
That's interesting.
That's all I know about him. But.
Well, I suppose Akron's a rubber capital, but you'd think starting something that competitive, they'd want to be in a different location. But
maybe they thought they could get more experienced people right here.
Yes.
They built it right next door. So
that's right. Yes.
Which is a little unusual.
Yeah, that is. That's.
But I do think perhaps it might have been better for the town. Mm-hmm. Had they been a little bit further apart. Now it doesn't make any difference, but during, I'd say, the first 10 to 15 years, it was a very bitter rivalry, and it wasn't good, I don't, because it divided the town too much.
Mm-hmm.
Some people were on one side of the fence and some on the other. Yeah. But it was rather unfortunate, but I don't think it's unusual, those things have happened.
That's right.
That's right. It's part of the industrial history of the United States. So.
Sure. Well, I'll tell you, the thing I miss now is not to see the Morgan smokestack.
I do.
Yeah, that was just such a landmark. And, of course,
they had the old sign where they lit up at night. You used to kind of see it from the passenger trains where they used to put it there.
Uh-huh.
I used to get kidded when I was in school. I got to.
But as you say, that's part of the industrial pattern and
it's gone like the passenger train.
Right.
The stackers.
Now, many people aren't aware that there is an iron grillwork fence or an iron fence, and there is a monument down there too.
Yeah, there's a plaque, and apparently Dan had this thing made of my grandfather. There's a little history on the side of the thing. About World War I, they took this plaque and made the monument. And I think it's this concrete thing. It sat for quite a long time near the driveway coming in from Morgan Avenue. And then in recent years, they moved it down, I'd say 25 years ago, down where it is now, on the Broadway side.
Have you, I presume you've been back to Wales and where your grandfather
grew up? Well, unfortunately, I've been in the United Kingdom several times, but I've never been in Wales in my life.
Is that right?
No. Which I should have done.
When I was in the service there,
they say it's beautiful country down there, and I'd love to do it sometime, but I don't know, I just never been there.
When I was in the service after the war was just over, we were putting in time there, and a young fella had met a girl in England. She was from Wales, went over to get married, and I said, "Where did you go?" He said, "I went to Glamorgan in Wales."
Oh, sure.
Quite a coincidence.
Oh,
and when I told him this, he, of course, had a couple furloughs to go back and see his bride, and they were quite intrigued that he knew someone would come from a line. So we had a Glamorgan castle.
Oh, sure. Grandfather came to Glamorgan.
Yes.
That's
right. So it was just one of those coincidences like that worked out.
I've met people, you know, you spell out the name of the street or something, say Glamorgan, and they say, "Glenmorgan?" I said, "No, this is Welsh, and I'm Scotch."
Yeah.
And then occasionally you have somebody that knows it. That's always a surprise, too. Well, I don't know where they're from. They're probably from Wales. I didn't know that.
What was the share, of course, with German, I suppose,
yes,
on that side, wasn't it?
Yes, sure. Mm-hmm.
German.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been a very interesting, I don't know, close on more of your time, but it's very interesting to have these insights on Morgan Engineering.
We've had a number of ups and downs in this company, too. Time my grandfather died in 1897, the company was in rather bad shape. Fortunately, he had quite a lot of life insurance, and that sort of got started and back on the right track again. And we overexpanded during World War I, bought a steel foundry in Canton, and also built the ordnance plant, which was on the south side of Summit Street, and has since been torn down. And we got into a very, very bad financial difficulty in 1926. And maybe it's fortunate we owed as much money as we did, because the creditors decided to keep us going, so they formed a creditors committee and made some changes. Well, fortunately for us, in the late 1920s, we were in a tremendous business boom, and we came out of the thing and paid off the creditors just in time to get into the Depression of the early 30s. So things were pretty rough for a while until World War II came along, and we started getting back on our feet again. But it hasn't been all gravy by a long shot.
There have been ups and downs.
You better have. Which I think is, again, true with any business.
That's true, yes. That's right.
You know, people who are on the outside think, this thing is a gold mine, you know, there's nothing to it. But any manufacturing business, they have problems. You have good times, you have bad ones, too.
Now, you had quite an apprenticeship program, didn't you, at Morgan's for years, too?
Yes. As I understand, back in the early part of the century, they had a very excellent apprentice program. And the thing had been let slide, I think, probably during this trouble after World War I. And I think I perhaps was instrumental in getting a good program started again, because I felt that unless we developed some talent coming along, our older people were retiring and getting out, and we'd be soon out of real skilled people. So we got a good apprentice program going back in the early 50s, I'd say, and it's been very helpful, because most of our top people in the plant today are graduates of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's one thing I really have been proud of.
That's the thing I always associated with Morgan, was the very fine apprenticeship. And of course, being specialized, they almost needed that.
Oh, definitely.
Yes.
You simply got to build. You can't just take all the time. We tried to.
Now,
that's worked out very well.
One other aspect, and of course this just touches the surface, you can't go into a lot of detail, but that is with labor relations, with unions. Over the years, how did this fluctuated
well,
and pretty
I would
well.
Say, I would say our relations, certainly, I'd say I haven't been there since
yes.
1964, but they were good. You probably recall back in the 30s when they had this tremendous drive of the CIO to mm-hmm. organize everything. Yeah. We had a CIO representative come down to the plant one day and said, well, tell us that we want to be represented here, we want this plant. He said, furthermore, I said, if you don't go along with us, we can bring down 20,000 pickets from Acker. This is an organizer ever interested in. So, Mr. Morris said, well, you can think it'd take quite 20,000 pickets to close the plant. Anyway, our people were not too happy about it. And we got a National Labor Relations Board election, and they decided not to go to the National and form the local union, Board of Employees Incorporated, which that have, as far as I know, still represents employees. But again, that has advantages and disadvantages. There's one thing with a national, big union, you have a little bit more sure leadership when you have a local. There's more
fluctuation.
Well, yeah, they flounder and they make an agreement, then they take it to the body and they turn it down and they have all sorts of trouble among themselves mm-hmm. and the thing. So I don't know their pluses and minuses. I don't know. But as far as the benefits and the labor rates and everything, they're pretty well standardized.
Yes.
You can't certainly. Couldn't run a plant, be way below it.
That's right.
Not
in this day. What would be the peak employment, personnel-wise, you'd say?
I would guess that the peak employment was during World War I when they were running that ordnance plant, and I think we ran nearly 3,000 people at that time.
Is that right?
I think so. But normally, we used to run between 800 and 900. That was an exceptional situation.
Yes. What would be the percent of what you would call real skilled workmen in that, say, the average, where you had 8 to 9?
Well, I would say, in that particular type of business, they were nearly all skilled. We didn't employ very much unskilled labor.
Mm-hmm.
As I would say, American Steel Foundries had many more unskilled.
Yes.
But we had quite skilled people.
Can you recall in your association or in the past, were there any major catastrophes, any sort of disaster in connection with the plant?
Well, I don't say any major catastrophe or anything. I do remember one story my father told me back before World War I, I would say we made all our own power down there. We had our own generating plant, steam engine, whatever. Well, I had a big curl of steam engine down there. And it had a tremendous big flywheel on it. I would imagine it must have been at least 15 or 18 feet in diameter. This thing was a rope drive, and there were must have been a dozen or more ropes across. And apparently one night, this thing was running, and the wire rope broke, and this end flew and knocked out the governor, which regulated the speed of the engine, and the thing ran away. The cars got moving faster and faster. And the engineer was scared to death. He couldn't get near the valve, turn it off. He just ran because he was afraid this flywheel would explode, which it did. And it knocked the end of the building out, and I guess they found pieces of it half and three quarters of a mile away. But fortunately, no one was hurt. Didn't hit anybody. It didn't happen during working hours,
yes.
Which was very lucky. But that's a, That's about the closest call I know that we had done. That was, again, that was before my time. That must have been around 1900
something. Fortunate it happened like that.
Oh, and lucky, just yes. Plain luck.
Yes.
Just, they replaced this thing. There was one I've seen the side of the engine bay. This thing was big.
Well, I certainly appreciate your time and coming to.
Well.